mind is boiling over with bees. And he moved those hives to Florida, as he does every year, and went back a month later and found that 2,000 of his 3,000 colonies were completely abandoned. And he was rather confident that it wasn't mites. And so he brought those colonies back, a couple of those colonies that were reduced size, and Diana took some samples, and we got some samples, and we looked at it, and we started hearing reports from around the country of a very similar condition, a similar complaint. And in fact, when we did a survey through the Apiary Inspectors of America, we found that there were a lot of losses. Now, there's a couple of very interesting things in this slide. The first thing you'll know is that if you look at the bottom there, over the people who managed over 500 colonies, that a beekeeper considered his losses normal if he lost 17% of his colonies. Now, that's astonishing at some level. Can you imagine any other agricultural production system that accepted a regular 17% loss and considered that normal? So that's an astonishing number in itself. However, last winter, 51% of the respondents described an abnormal loss, so losses that were above normal, and in that commercial beekeeper group, they lost about 55% of their colonies, some as many as 70 or 80% of their colonies. Not all of those losses were CCD. In fact, we estimate only 25% of those abnormal losses were CCD. So by far and away, most colonies died from starvation and from varroa or other things that the beekeeper suggested what that cause of death was. But it's that other element, that other group of beekeepers, those migratory beekeepers who have experienced high losses that are of concern, because they can lose that number of colonies 1 year in a row, but they can't lose that number of colonies 2 years in a row and stay in business. And this is the segment of the industry that move their colonies up and down the coasts to meet the pollination demand. So I think they're a very important group. So what is CCD? How do we measure or figure out what CCD is? And it is a symptom-based diagnosis. And it's described as being the rapid loss of adult bees from these colonies. And we know it was a rapid loss because in many cases we see very large populations of brood and not enough bees to cover it. And so if the colony is not completely abandoned, we don't find dead bees in the colony, we don't find them in the apiary. If there are bees left, they tend to be very young bees and the queen. Now, we've been monitoring colonies, and I'll just briefly touch on this later on in the talk, but we've been monitoring colonies all year, trying to look for CCD. And all year, you know, we saw colonies that weren't growing properly, but we never saw this classic symptom until 2 weeks ago in Florida. And so it seems to have some seasonality, this classic sign of symptom or this classic loss. So when this came up, you know, there were a lot of theories proposed. Some of these theories have been dismissed. Cell phones, we do not think, is the cause of CCD. However, beekeepers are not advised to give their bees cell phone because they'll only pollinate blackberries. We do not believe that the bees were raptured or aliens abducted them or that it is a terrorist threat. However, maybe one of you want to prove that. So what we do think is we sort of have three principal lines of investigation. The idea of a pathogen, either newly evolved or newly introduced, the idea of a pesticide, either a beekeeper applied, because beekeepers have to apply these miticides to control varroa mite and these other mites, or farmer applied, that the bees are bringing back, or an environmental stress, and I use that term loosely to talk about nutrition and genetics. And so these are the principal hypothesis. Now, it could very well be, and I'll make this argument at the end of the talk, that it's a combination of these things, so a multifactorial thing, the perfect storm, if you like. So, of course, it's hard to sample bees if the symptom is there are no dead bees in the colony. So what we did was we with the USDA, went to Florida and California and sampled colonies that had come from 11 different states. You can see the picture on the top is from Florida, and the picture on the bottom is California, and I think that's a really enlightening picture, because when I first saw this in the valley, I thought it was snow on the bottom of the valley, and in fact, in that one valley, in your eyesight, you could see more colonies in California in January than there are in the state of Pennsylvania in the middle of the summer. So you can see there's this huge congregation of colonies. So if there is a contagious condition, you can imagine that could be spread rather quickly. You can imagine, too, that you have to be very aggressive about providing food for these colonies, because that's an issue. So we found colony or apiaries that there was active collapse in. So we saw dead colonies, we saw strong colonies, and we saw these weak colonies. And so I'll be talking about those principally in the next couple of slides. We also found a couple of colonies where the colonies had been declining and then seemed to be rebounding or recovering. So that was a group. Some beekeepers had added packages to their colonies to increase the size, and some had been established as packages. Of course, we also had some control apiaries where we had strong and sometimes weak colonies in that control apiary, but the weak colonies did not demonstrate that symptom of CCD. We collected bees on alcohol, we collected them on dry ice, and we took a section of comb. And I want to just talk a little bit about what we did with these samples. The first thing we did was we measured the colonies when we were there. And I bring up this slide to say that one of the things, the symptom-based analysis, we're trying to work towards having something to a quantifiable measure. And that measure is perhaps going to be related to the ratio of bees to brood. Of course, you want a good coverage of bees on brood to keep that brood warm and well-fed. And certainly, if we look at the colonies that were in the CCD apiaries, they had a reduced bees-to-brood ratio. So it wasn't that good, strong coverage. And so we're looking at that as perhaps a measure that we can use. Now, there is a weakness in that measure, because if you're a beekeeper, you know that colonies experience spring dwindle. So in the spring, you can see this reduced adult population with too much brood. And so it's not a perfect one, but I think this clearly demonstrates that there is something different in that population ratio. So we sent different samples out. So we looked at alcohol samples for honeybee trachomite, varroa, and nosema. The picture on the top is not honeybee trachomite, but Jeff Pettis, and I put that there because I want to emphasize that his lab did this analysis. And when we looked at that analysis, the first thing that became, this was startling, we see, if you look at this, it looks like, if we're looking at varroa mites, or the number of mites per 100 bees, this suggests that, well, varroa explains this. In fact, if you look at the median, though, so the number, the average, or where the halfway mark in varroa mite population, we see that in the strong colonies and the weak colonies in the CCD operations, those are well below threshold. There were a couple of colonies that had extremely high varroa mites, and that's bumped up the median. But as a median, there were lots of colonies in these CCD groups that had no mites at all, or no detectable mites at all. So we can't claim that it's varroa mite, I think. The same is true for Nosema. If you look at the average mean levels, it looks like Nosema is a very large player. However, in many cases, if we look at the median Nosema levels, it's zero for both strong and weak colonies in the CCD yards. That means that at least half the colonies had no detectable level of Nosema. And so we had a couple of colonies that had very high levels of Nosema, and certainly that is a concern, and that is probably a very likely contributor to it, but by and large, it couldn't explain all the cases of collapse. I think it's also important to realize that the colonies that had packages added or were established from Australia bees had very high levels of Nosema. And it is illegal in Australia to treat for Nosema, and so that's something that beekeepers need to consider. The alcohol samples, we at my lab at PDA, we did some autopsies. We were looking for a way of seeing if there was a non-molecular diagnostic technique. And we found a couple of interesting things I'll highlight here. We found, in fact, that these nodules, which I thought couldn't be very good for bees, but in fact that in the recovering bees, 83% of the bees taken out of recovering colonies had these nodules. And so one of the lines of investigation in the future is trying to figure out what these white nodules are. We also looked at a lot of different parts of the digestive system. Something that did spring out was melanization on the sting gland. So this is the sting gland here, and then of course the venom sac at the bottom. And we saw an awful lot of, 42% of bees from the CCD apiaries had this melanization versus 22% in the non-CCD apiaries. And again, we have to figure out what that is. Another thing are the malpighial tubules, or the kidneys of the bees. And we found a lot of this pebbling. One of my technicians called it a sparkling effect. We found this sort of granular tissue in a lot of the CCD bees, and 17% of them versus 2% in the non-CCD bees. So there are some anatomical differences that we're hoping to try to figure out in the next couple of years. We also took a lot of frozen bees, and you can see these bees up here, and those frozen bees got spread out to a lot of different labs. So Jay Evans got some, and we're going to hear some of the results from that work. Diana Cox Foster got some and passed those on to some of her colleagues as well. Dave Tarpey did some to do genetic and protein profiling or protein content. The Illinois group got some, and we'll be hearing the results from that to do some of their work. And so we spread these same samples out to these groups or a subset of these samples. We also collected pollen or bee bread, which is the protein, of course, that the bees bring back. And we gave this to Mary Ann Fraser, Jim Fraser, and Chris Mullen to do pesticide analysis. And we also did the wax analysis for miticides. And I'll let them speak to it. I think, though, that it, just like with the vorolamide and Nosema, nothing has come out as the clear smoking gun, that there's not a monofactorial thing here. So we need to now get all that data together and sort of do a multifactorial analysis. I'm just going to present with the protein data. Dave Tarpey was looking for the protein content in the bees as a surrogate for nutrition suppression or lack of good nutrition. There was no effect for that, but one interesting thing that did result from that was that when we weighed or took the mass of the bees' heads and the thoraxes, it turned out that recovering group of bees also tended to have bigger heads than the other bees in our study. So there's something interesting going on in that recovering group. I don't think that any discussion of CCD is complete without at least some discussion of the press. The press has been is a monster, and it needs to be fed, you know? And it's been overwhelming, and it's been a very big learning curve. But I also think that in it there's also some hope, because there's been this huge interest, I think, from the general public about bees, and we've been trying to figure that out. And I think it's, you know, in a world full of global warming and war and all these other things, we can't really comprehend that. But I think at a very innate level, the general public realizes that bees are good, and a world without bees isn't the same. And so I think that when that barrage is coming, it's good to remind ourselves that it's an indication of general interest, and that has to be a good thing. And the message is not that CCD is here and there's, you know, it's going to be terrible, but, you know, pollinators are important and we need to be protecting them. And I think that message has been getting out, and I think that's something that the whole, like a lot of you in this room and a lot of people on that team have been helping spread. I do want to talk briefly about one of the studies that has been ongoing. With the USDA and North Carolina State, we've been monitoring colonies in three migratory operations as they move up and down the coast and sampling every month. One of the problems with our CCD sampling, of course, is that you know, it was just one picture at one point in time. And so hopefully this then was a longitudinal study, so we can look over time at what happens, and then we can go back to those colonies that have collapsed and look back in time at the samples we've collected. We've also initiated a study where we irradiated dead out equipment and treated it with different things to see if that can help with the bees, and certainly those studies are ongoing, and we'll be presenting some of that hopefully at the big bee meetings in Sacramento in January. So if I were to summarize the future directions, one of the things that we really do realize we need is a quantitative in-field measure. So we have something that, you know, is sort of a, you know, you have CCD when. Hopefully we can develop that and test that. We have to do the multifactorial analysis, and certainly we're still getting some of the data in, and then hopefully we'll run that. And of course these longitudinal studies where we're looking over time at samples to see if we can predict colony loss or not. Of course, there's the obligatory funding thing, and I think this is important to note, that most of this was done on a shoestring budget and emergency funding here and there, And I think there's been a lot of creativity here in finding funding. The National Honey Board has certainly taken a very prominent leadership role in funding some of these projects and some of these analyses, which are not cheap. I mean, to do the wax and pollen analysis in a colony is over $300 a sample, and we have 100 samples to do, so you can do the math. You know, the Foundation for the Preservation of Honeybees has given us some money. The Eastern Apicultural Society, a lot of beekeeping organizations have given some money. Different state and governments have given money. Penn State has given some of its internal resources. One of the things that I individual beekeepers have been very good. I mean, there's a guy in Florida who sent all our frozen samples to all the universities that needed them for free. He covered the cost, and that's quite substantial. You know, that's nearly $1,000 of FedEx he's done for us. And also there's this wonderful story of the lady in Brooklyn, 16-year-old lady, who's raised over $10,000 and given it to CCD Research at Penn State. So that's been a silver lining and a real, you know, that's a nice thing about this whole year, I suppose. So that's my talk, and thank you for being here.
For one question, if anyone has a question for Dennis.
Is large beekeeping operations?
Yeah. Thanks for asking that question. The question is this only affecting large commercial beekeepers? The answer is no. It's affecting the whole sort of gamut of beekeepers. So we're seeing it in smaller operations. But it's the large ones that are of most concern, because they're the critical ones, and if they go out of business, they're not easy to replace.
The 90% purity is a good target. And in transgenic plants, often the active ingredients and the selectable marker proteins are produced in low concentrations, and it makes it very difficult or indeed impossible to obtain the required amount and purity of the protein from the transgenic plant. It is, however, relatively easy to overexpress the proteins in microbes, such as E. coli, and we can obtain large amounts of highly pure protein from these sources. And therefore, in most cases, we, meaning Syngenta and the rest of the industry, produce our protein test substances for safety studies in microbial systems. Now, as Jörg has described, the purpose of these studies is to test hypotheses, and a very conservative one is that the exposure of the organism in the field, the expected environmental concentration, is lower than the concentration that has no observable adverse effect. And the confidence in the risk assessment comes from the rigor with which we can test a hypothesis such as that. And the reason we need a rigorous test is that we're extrapolating to other species that we've not tested, and there may be variation in exposure in the field. And using purified protein helps to obtain a margin of exposure. That's to say, the exposure in the study is higher than the predicted exposure in the field. And that gives us the chance to show that the ratio between the EEC and the no observable adverse effect concentration, the hazard quotient, is well below one, not just one or slightly below, it's well below one. And that gives us the required rigor to make robust predictions. So the quantity of the test substance is an important criterion, and is one of the reasons why we need to use microbial protein. In some studies, it is possible to achieve a high margin of exposure using plant tissue. You can use pollen-rich diets, where you could have high loads of transgenic plant material in aquatic test systems. And you could compare the effects of the transgenic and non-transgenic tissue on your test organism. The problem with that is, if you detect an effect, you're not sure whether it's due to the toxin or to other differences between the transgenic and non-transgenic plant material. And there are several studies in the literature where the authors have ascribed observed differences to differences other than the presence or absence of the transgenic proteins. The wood lice, predatory mites, and aphids, for example, we've seen differences of the performance of those insects on transgenic and non-transgenic plant material, but it was due to differences other than the presence of the transgenic proteins. So purity of test substance is also an important criterion. So when we have our microbial protein, we run through a series of studies to examine the composition of that test substance and also to examine whether it's a suitable surrogate for the protein that's produced in the plant. And the kinds of studies we'll do are to test its purity, its solubility, its activity, which could include bioactivity, immunoreactivity, glycosylation, and its mass, its amino acid sequence. And these tests are very simple in concept, but they're very important. Test substance purity, that's done in two stages. The first thing to do is to measure the total protein in your test substance. There are various methods for doing that. And then once you've done that, you assess the proportion of that protein that is your protein of interest. So it's two stages there. And it almost goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, you need to know the purity of your test substance in order to ensure the correct dosing in your safety studies. Test substance solubility, looking at its solubility in water and aqueous solutions, a very simple test. Simply just put your test substance in your solution and see whether it dissolves. And this allows you to design optimal buffers for your experiments. If you have the wrong buffer, that'll give you a poor or an invalid study. It's such a simple test, it's often overlooked. I remember a contract lab phoning me up on a Friday afternoon saying, why won't the test substance dissolve in the sugar solution we're about to dose the bees? And it was because the test substance needed a high pH buffer to dissolve. So that test was scrubbed and we had to start again. So it's a really important point to test the solubility of your test substance. Test substance activity, if you're working with an enzyme, then this could be expressed in units of activity per gram of test substance or per gram of active ingredient. If you're working with a toxin, then biological activity, insecticidal activity will be important, something like percentage mortality over time or the LC50. And activity, including biological activity, is probably the most important criterion for demonstrating equivalence of the microbial and plant proteins. If your microbial and plant proteins have different activity, you're very unlikely to convince anyone that the microbial protein is a suitable surrogate for your plant protein. Just some data here. This is VIP3A, a Lepidopteran-specific toxin, and expressed in maize. And these data just show that the LC50 of the microbial test substance, that's VIP3A, 0204, is comparable with the protein that's expressed in the plant. Very similar LC50s. A Western blot analysis, this is to look at the size of the protein and its immunoactivity. And on this gel here, we're looking at a protein that confers herbicide tolerance, and lanes 2 and 3 is the microbial test substance, lanes 4 to 7 are various plant extracts, and 8 and 9 is total plant protein. And you can see that the antibody is binding to all of those proteins, and it's detecting a protein of what appears to be the same size. Glycosylation, microbial test proteins produced in microbes will not be glycosylated, but the protein in the plant may be glycosylated, and that could cause non-equivalence. And testing for glycosylation is quite simple in concept. The OH group on a sugar, you have a series of reactions that can add an alkaline phosphatase molecule to it, which catalyzes a color reaction in the presence of the right substrates. And on this gel here, lanes 1 to 3 are a positive control with a glycosylated protein that's giving a strong band there. And then 6 and 7 are extracts from a transgenic plant expressing VIP3A. And lanes 8 and 9 are a microbial test substance containing VIP3A. And you'll see there's no bands lighting up there at the predicted molecular weight of VIP3A. So neither the plant protein nor the microbial protein are glycosylated, showing equivalence in glycosylation of those two substances. You also look at the total mass of the protein. This can be done on a gel, but it's quite insensitive. Looking here at a microbial test substance, MCRY3A 0102, which contains modified CRY3A, which is active against Western corn rootworm. You can see on the gel there, there's a single band at about 67 kilodaltons. But by mass spectrometry, we can get a much more sensitive reading of the mass. And this is very important. The first thing that it can do is to show you whether your protein is glycosylated or not. But the second thing is its sensitivity at detecting differences in size. We discovered that this test substance was actually a mixture of two forms of modified CRY3A at about 67.5 and 69.5 kilodaltons, which led to a whole load more studies to demonstrate the equivalence of those two forms. So mass spectrometry, very sensitive, a way of determining the mass of your protein. Do some amino acid sequencing just to make sure that your microbial protein is giving you is what you expected it to be. You can separate the proteins on a gel, cut out your protein of interest, and then by a series of reactions you can you get the N-terminal amino acid, and that's identified by HPLC, and you can keep doing that up to about 20 amino acids before you run out of test substance to keep on going. And here we did about 12 for BIT3A from a microbial test substance, and it gave us the predicted amino acid sequence showing that the microbial test substance contained the protein of interest. Finally, peptide mass mapping. This is a fingerprinting technique where you digest your protein with an enzyme such as trypsin and then shoot the fragments down a mass spectrometer. And you can, from the size of the fragments and knowledge of the sites where the enzyme acts, you can infer the protein sequence. And you can get quite good coverage. That the red there is predicted amino acid sequence, and the black is areas where we don't have any knowledge. But it's a very good method for getting sequence data of your protein and then comparing the microbial and the plant proteins. This list is probably not exhaustive, but there are various ways in which the microbial and plant substances can differ, detected by some of the tests that I've described. The amino acid sequence may differ between the microbial and plant proteins. You may have mixtures of proteins in these test substances. You may perhaps want to use a truncated protein when your plant expresses a full-length protein or vice versa. And also, there's this problem about tags. Sometimes when you're purifying your microbial test substance, make the protein is produced with a tag on it to ease purification. And sometimes it's difficult to get the tag off, and sometimes when you remove the tag, you remove some amino acids at the terminus of the protein. So those can introduce non-equivalence with the plant protein. Now, the acceptability of a particular test substance will vary depending on the nature of the difference that you've detected between the plant and microbial proteins. And it's really between you and your regulator as to the acceptability of a microbial protein that differs from the plant protein. But I think it's fair to say that for insecticidal proteins, unless you have comparable bioactivity, then you're not going to convince anyone that you have a suitable surrogate for your plant protein. So how do we use these microbial test substances in studies? Well, for some studies it's very simple. Mammal and bird studies, it's by gavage. You simply introduce the protein in a capsule into the animal's stomach. Other studies, as Marco has alluded to, you need to mix the test substance into an artificial diet. And often, it's not easy to formulate a diet for a non-target arthropod study. You need to maintain normal development of the insect with low mortality, but you also need to make sure that the protein is stable and to ensure that the animal is exposed to the protein. And I'll just mention some examples here, aureus, bacillus, and ladybird studies with different methods of exposing the animals to these proteins. So aureus, this is a test species in EU crop protection environmental risk assessments, and the usual diet is eggs of a moth, Festia. Now you could coat the eggs with a microbial test substance, indeed this has been done in similar studies, but the problem is that the aureus may not be exposed because it feeds by piercing its prey. So if you were to coat the egg and it sticks its mouth parts into the egg to feed on the insides, it's not going to be exposed to much, if any, protein. So what we did was to look in the literature, and that there are various diets, and one is based on meat and liver. And it also got various other things like honey and yeast and egg yolk in it. And so we made up this diet and we microwaved it because we thought that the